We've heard a lot this morning about some of the issues facing retirees and future retirees in Australia, and Anthony's just shared with us how some of the other markets around the world are addressing these issues. What I want to do is share with you what I believe to be the beginning of a new wave of innovation in the Australian market. I think I'm going to walk you through our product development experience. I think it's a toe in the door for the market, but I fully expect that there will be a lot more impetus and a lot more activity in this market in this area in the years to come. First, I'm going to start with a little bit of a walk through the evolution of retirement incomes in Australia as seen by Pauline Blight. So this is purely my view. If you look back 20 years ago, to the extent there were retirement incomes being provided, retirement income products in Australia, they were typically lifetime annuities, guaranteed products. You give us your $100,000 now, we'll pay you $10,000 a year till the day you die. Now, guaranteed income, and the provider was taking all of the risk, both the mortality risk and the investment risk, and arguably probably not pricing for it properly. Certainly towards the end of the reign of lifetime annuities, there were questions about how well that risk was being priced for and understood, and I think a lot of the providers around town are still suffering from some of the decisions made towards the end of the reign of those products. They were capital intensive. Once we woke up as an industry to what risks we were actually taking on and the regulator cottoned onto it, all of a sudden they became incredibly capital intensive as well. That drove the industry as a whole to start pricing for the risk and then drove the consumers away from that as a product because it was no longer so exciting. About that time, say about the early 90s, I'd say what I consider to be the pendulum swung. It swung towards the allocated pension, which is almost the opposite end of the spectrum. You can't picture anything more different. The pensioner is suddenly taking all of the risk. They're taking the mortality risk, they're taking the market risk. Very sensible product from the provider's perspective. Low capital, low risk, very easy to run. But if you think about all the issues with the previous product from the provider's perspective, it's exactly mirrored now from the customer's perspective. They're now taking on risks they don't understand. And they're probably less able to understand it than the company was. Whilst I think allocated pensions have a very valuable role to play in our retirement income system and they're very valuable for retirement planning purposes, I've always been uncomfortable that we have a problem that is going to emerge over time, and that is that some of our pensioners have taken these on for the wrong reasons. That there's an element of people who haven't understood the risks they're taking on or haven't consciously chosen to take on those risks. While ever these are the only products really available in the market, I think they're being applied across too broad a range of customer. And I think we've been very fortunate, as we know in the last 15 years, we've had a dream run for market returns in Australia. But now, what happens if markets turn down in the medium term? And also, I think the longevity risk is going to start to become apparent fairly soon. These products have been sold now for, say, 15 years. Probably at the time they're expecting about a 20-year life expectancy. What's going to happen in the next 5 years? And then if we compound a market shock to that, are we going to have a group of people who have bought a product that actually didn't satisfy the need they thought they were trying to satisfy? I think it's an industry issue that we need to have one eye to. And I think that's what's going to cause what I call the pendulum coming back towards a more natural, long-term, sustainable position where we share that risk. This is probably just another way of looking at what the diagram that Anthony had with the Australian retirement income system at one end of the spectrum and the US at the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I think Anthony's view is that both markets will actually converge towards the middle. I think it's the same thing that I'm saying here. I think to provide a sustainable, long-term solution to retirement incomes, we're going to have to share the risks. I think there's going to be a new generation of products that we're already seeing overseas and we'll start to see in Australia whereby policyholders have some or customers have the potential to choose what level of risk they're prepared to accept. Obviously we need the advice to help them choose that. Where we can share the risk between the cohort of customers, the same we do with insurance risk, and where we can use that to generate upside to those customers that need it. So we can provide a better return to the customers that live longer because we're using some insurance techniques that, as actuaries, we're all very familiar with. I'm not going to spend long on the forces of change. When I drafted this slide, I didn't realise that the whole morning was going to be on that, which is fantastic. It saves me going through it. So we're all very aware after this morning of the forces of change. I think the last one I've got down the bottom there, the current affairs effect, I'll just spend a minute on. Following on from the last point I was making about the allocated pensions and mortality catching up with us and a market shock, you know, I'm not a journalist, but I reckon that's going to make a pretty good current affairs story. Can't you just see it? Poor old Mrs. Smith, you know, the insurance company sold her this product and now she can't afford to buy her kids Christmas presents or whatever it happens to be. I think as an industry, that is going to create an impetus for change for us. What I want to introduce you to now is something I'm really excited about, and that's ALICE, the Astron Longevity Income Stream. I'm excited for a number of reasons. One, I'm an actuary and I quite like the idea of new ways to deal with risk. But moving forward, I'm actually excited because I think that it's providing a real solution to a real need. And I think that ALICE is not the end state. ALICE is a start. And if the industry is moving in this direction, I think we can actually add value to the world. And if we add value to the world, we generate a profitable, viable, growing industry. So now, what does ALICE do? I'm going to start introducing it in a way that makes sense. It's a little bit of a complicated product, and I think that's part of the issue with this, anything new. So here we go. What you do when you retire, instead of buying an allocated pension, you would put, say, 80% of your retirement income funds into an allocated pension, and you'd take about 20% of it, and you'd pay essentially an insurance premium to the insurance company. That 20% goes into what we call the establishment phase, goes away for 20 years. You then live off your allocated pension for the next 20 years. The advantage of that is you know you only need to get 20 years out of your allocated pension. So you've taken away all the mortality risk instantly. This comes back to what Catherine was saying earlier about the ideas of the government providing those kind of options for people to be able to defer their old age pension so they can live off their allocated pension for a defined period of time and take away that risk factor. Then when you hit what we call the conversion age, which the policyholder can choose, anywhere between 80 and 85, ALICE will pay out an annual income for the rest of your life. It's a standalone product. It's not actually sold wrapped with an allocated pension, which means you can actually choose how much of it goes into ALICE and how much of it goes into your allocated pension based on the relativity you want between your income beyond age 85 and pre-age 85. Some of the key features of the product, it's a real case of back to the future. What we're relying on here is risk sharing and risk pooling. That's what made this industry great. That's what created this industry, and that's what gave most of us jobs for a very long time. That's where we actually added real value to the world over and above what a lot of fund managers can do. So it's a product based on risk pooling, risk sharing, and providing the incomes to those that are still around beyond age 85 that need it. It has limited guarantees in it, but it has some guarantees. So again, we're trying to strike that balance between the risk with the provider and the risk with the customer. Has limited withdrawal and death benefits. Again, it's geared towards retirement income. It's a superannuation product and there are no income tax or Centrelink disadvantages. That sounds easy to say, but you can imagine how long that took. Okay, just on the limited withdrawal and death benefits, it's actually quite interesting. Developing a new product, you've probably all had experience of this, and everybody sits in a room and all the product people come back with all the feedback. You know, your deferred annuity product would be fantastic if only we paid out the full premium as a death benefit. Kind of like yeah, and what would we be insuring against then? So a little bit more detail about how it works. In the establishment phase, we take the initial contributions from all of the customers. They all go into a ring-fenced asset pool. That asset pool, as you would expect, earns investment returns. It has a diversified asset mix, so you're getting some upside. You're not just stuck with your fixed interest style returns. Within the asset pool building up, there are notional amounts allocated to each member. It's not an account balance. Members don't see account balances. But we know there's a notional reserve for each member. Any members that pass away during the establishment phase receive a small death benefit, enough to fund funeral costs and a few other bits and pieces. The difference between their notional reserve and the death benefit goes back into the pool to fund the incomes of those that survive. Coming out of the asset pool are fees, death benefits, withdrawal benefits, and conversions. On conversion, you enter the income phase. Once you're in the income phase, you're in another separate ring-fenced asset pool. into that asset pool go conversion benefits, investment returns, and I'll come back to the last one, essentially conversion benefits and investment returns. Out of that asset pool come annuity payments and fees. At this point in time, the annuity payments are variable. So as the asset pool expands or contracts or mortality changes, the payments, individual payments to individual annuitants change. However, there's an 80% guarantee on each annuitant from the day they convert. So the day they enter the product, there's no guarantee on their annuity income stream. On the day they convert, they get told, okay, your income stream for the first year we expect to be $10,000. If they were told $10,000, then they would have a guaranteed minimum benefit every year till they died of $8,000. The $10,000 could go up, it could go down, but it won't go down below $8,000. That's where we get the other thing that goes into the pool, which is a guarantee top-up. If ever we're at a point where the markets have disappointed or the longevity risks are greater than we expected and the calculations tell us we've got to reduce everybody's income payments down to about 75% of what we thought, at that point we need to top up the pool. So there is some risk for the company. That's the only risk that's not shared between the members. What are the key learnings from this product? I would say that there's no question that the legislation we have in place today hampers true product innovation. There's absolutely no question about that. And any legislator, anybody responsible for any one piece of legislation will say their piece doesn't, and they're probably right. But by the time it's just you lay on top of the income tax legislation, the Social Security, the life insurance, the, I can't think of them all on the spot, CIS, disclosure. We could go on for days yelling out different types of legislation. By the time you lay all those up, it's like getting a whole series of stencils on top of each other and then you've got to drive something through the hole. Each one's easy on its own, but it's very, very complex when you bring them all together. And I think as an industry, that is a real challenge. The interesting thing for us that the product nearly fell over at the very last minute. We'd gotten through all of those pieces of legislation. And the thing that nearly caught us at the end was Actuarial Standard 402, which most of you probably aren't even aware of, which is about minimum surrender values. We found a way through it at the end, and I believe the LIASB is currently changing that standard to help future innovators of this product. God. The other thing for me was that actuaries have a key role to play. The difference between this product and every other product development I've been involved in is it didn't come out of the marketing department. It came out of a group of people who understand this industry, largely actuaries, sitting around going, we see a problem. I think that's really exciting. I think it shows that we have a real role to play in understanding what the market needs and how to provide it and using our skills to take the market forward and to provide these things rather than just sitting back and saying, not sure about things like that. We've also found the awareness of longevity risk is patchy. That's been a really interesting finding. We get, when I explain this product, we get all sorts of responses, ranging from, by the time I'm 85, I'll be so decrepit and insane, I won't care, to, and there's people who relate to that in the room probably, and to, I'm just watching my parents go through this right now. These are typically 60-year-olds who are in the target market. I'm watching my parents go through this right now and it's awful. I never want to go through it. Can you sell me one yesterday, please? And typically the difference between whether people think this is a great idea or not is their own parental experience, which is potentially a bit of a warning because if you think about the genetic effects of that on the longevity pool. Okay. The other thing I'd say is the education process is slow. It's like anything. It's new. It's different. It's going to take people a while to get their head around it. And I think potentially we're possibly a little bit ahead of our time in this market. I think over the next few years, as people become more aware of the impacts of longevity, potentially if we have a market downturn, I think the benefits of these type of products will become more apparent. So I guess the key message that I'm trying to get through is that I believe there is a real need to innovate in this market. It's not easy. Let's face it, if innovation was easy, everybody would be doing it all the time, but it is possible. And I think if the non-actuaries in the room will forgive me this little plug, I do believe there's a real need for actuaries. But I think that's good news for all of us, for the actuaries and the non-actuaries. This industry became very lucrative because we provided a service that others couldn't provide. We accepted risk, we managed it, we dealt with it in a way that others couldn't do that. We've walked away from that and we've become a lot more commoditised, and the margins in the industry have suffered because of it. If we can nail this and really start to innovate in this area and take on more risk and go back to what it is that insurance companies originally created value through doing, I think that's an exciting prospect for the whole industry, as well as for the actuaries in the room. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Pauline. I actually share your enthusiasm for the product in the sense, to me, it embodies a lot of principles that I've heard actuaries discuss in forums like this for probably at least a decade, and now here's a product that actually embodies them, although I'm not quite sure what that will do for market acceptance, but I guess time will tell. Mm-hmm. We've got a little bit under 15 minutes for questions to Anthony or Pauline. So does anyone have a question or a comment? Yes, thank you.
I'm just interested in how you, James Maitland, just interested in how you hedge the guarantee risk without a liquid bond market. That's you, Pauline.
The guarantee risk is very small, and we haven't actually taken it on yet. We won't be taking it on for 20 years. The other advantage, so it'll be someone else's problem, but the real answer to that... the real answer to that is by the time we're actually at that point, so we've got 80 to 85-year-old retirees, we're actually talking about a life expectancy where we can hedge it, because we're not talking about a 20-year, 30-year life expectancy. We're now talking about a 10-year life expectancy. It's much easier to hedge at that point in time.
Yes, Anthony.
Anthony Ashland. I'm sorry, again to Pauline, really, but thanks so much. I love it. I think you're absolutely right, a real need for actuaries. But I've been in the sort of trying to dream up a new income stream products for some 25 years. I think designed my first with-profit annuity in 1984. Not very successfully, and so I've had plenty of time to think about why they don't succeed in a way that you expect them to. And I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that when 75% of pensioners are actually on the state pension, there's what the Social Security people call it's crowded out at the one end. And of course, very wealthy people don't need it anyway. So you're just left with upper and middle class people, which actuaries are, and so therefore we see the need. But the one suggestion is that I think actuaries need it's really important for actuaries to be there, but I do think there are two other groups that need to be involved. The one is the the marketing people. It's really a question of trying to find ways of helping the distribution arm to actually sell it, because they don't understand it, and if they don't understand it fully, they're really not in a position to sell. And then the other side is to, I think, Michael Rice's point about the three stages of retirement, I think, is really important, sort of, because a lot of people, when they get to 85, actually have got in a different need stream to where they would have been, a different group to where they would have been in 65. And I'd like to then just give a real plug for Hilda, which Anne Harding mentioned earlier. Hilda's the Household Income and Labour Dynamic Study of Australia, which is based at the University of Melbourne, and it follows people through their retirement phases to see what they actually do. And the real difficulty, I mean, if we're going to design products, we really should be seeing the impact on the people that get the benefits, not the people who pay the premiums. And that seems to me always why life insurance is difficult to sell. But so those are two groups. I was wondering, have you managed to get other people involved in your committee? Because I really think if we go, we need a sort of an interdisciplinary force rather than just actuaries and administrators.
Absolutely. Whilst I said the impetus came from a group of managerial people and largely actuaries, we lost control of it pretty quickly, as you can imagine, to the marketing people. So when I say lost control, we then fell back to, I guess, a more typical actuarial role in that. There was a lot of market research done, a lot of work in distribution, and all the typical things you would expect in product development.
So just an additional point. One of the, I guess, one of the challenges with things like HILDA is that they're looking at, it's kind of looking in the rearview mirror, and it might tell you what's happened over the last 5 years or the last 10 years or however many, but it doesn't necessarily, or may not actually give you much idea about the people that you're selling to now, what their needs are going to be and what their situation is going to be in 15, 20 years' time. So there's still a little bit of crystal ball gazing required.
Yes, Angie.
Given the experiences of men and women in retirement is very different, given that you're more likely to have generational widows rather than widowers, how much was gender issues involved in your product development?
That affects the way the longevity boost is, from a technical perspective, affects the way the longevity boost is allocated. So mortality factors affect that, so we get actuarial fairness between the distribution of those ex-surplus profits. That's a technical answer. From the marketing and consumer perspective, it's women we're selling to. Absolutely the worried wife. Yeah, it's absolutely who we're selling to. And you see couples come along and the husband buys one to shut his wife up, or because he doesn't want to feel guilty about leaving her on her own, essentially.
Do you think that reversionary product would go from the male to the female at some stage?
There are reversionary options on it.
Okay.
Yes, Mike.
Mike Barker. Question mainly for Anthony, but an update on what's happening overseas with guarantees, hedging and reserving. We've seen guarantees go wrong with the Equitable Life, and we've seen a whole lot of new products coming up which are providing guarantees. As I understand it, in America, those guarantees are pretty much all hedged, and they're hedged on the assumption that that hedging will work forever and the markets will always be infinite and bottomless, and there will never be any capacity constraints in the markets. Going north of the border, as I understand it, in Canada, they rarely hedge. They just rely on reserves. And I've seen some interesting work from Mary Hardy at the University of Waterloo that indicates that according to what models you use, your reserves may vary by a factor of 5 or more even. Last I heard, which was over a year ago, there was some controversy over just what reserves ought to be set for companies that don't hedge. Now, I'm not sure what's happening in the UK. Perhaps you could give us an update, or maybe I'm just horribly out of date and it's all resolved.
Yeah, sure. Just, I guess, picking up first on the US and Canada experience, a lot of companies in the US are hedging, and there's a number of different ways that they go about doing it. Although it sounds very sophisticated, a lot of the companies are still actually hedging their GAAP profits rather than hedging the underlying economic exposure. So there's still a little bit of a way to go there. Pricing hasn't quite joined up with hedging either. So, pricing might be on one basis, and then they go to market to do the hedging and find that actually it's cost something different. So, the US market has moved things along, but there's still some way to go. But where a lot of the innovation has been is around the dynamic hedging. So it's rather than assuming that there's always going to be some kind of market, it's much more around, well, let's look at the range of assets that are available today and what portfolio of basic assets, options, and asset strategies will best, be the cheapest way of removing the risk. Most companies don't try and hedge away 100% of the risk, but you can get rid of 75-80% by simple delta hedging strategies. The biggest challenge there, and I think where even the reserving and capital standards haven't caught up, is the policyholder behavior risk. Because you're still making assumptions about how many policyholders are actually going to invoke the benefits and what kind of behavior they're going to have even over the short term. A lot of the GMWBs are priced on an assumption that only 30% of policyholders who buy the option actually invoke it, even if it may be optimal for 100% of them to do so. So there's some big challenges there on the pricing and on the hedging front. In Canada, I think companies are starting to recognize the benefits of hedging, and certainly we're aware of a number of companies who are putting in place dynamic hedging strategies even north of the border. from UK perspective, the guarantees have largely gone out of the market, at least the traditional type of guarantees. So with-profits products are virtually dead now. Annuity-style products are they're not options. They may be guarantees, but you can match them with swaps or something like that, provided you get your longevity assumptions right. What we're seeing now with these new-style products and the few companies that have entered the market, some of them have basically just white-labeled an investment bank product. So they just buy a guarantee from Goldman Sachs and then stick an insurance sticker on it and off you go. Some products are using CPPI type portfolio insurance, but those are really not meeting particular needs. Those products are sort of cohort based. You stick your money in, it has an offer period, it starts on the end of the quarter, runs for 5 years, you get a point guarantee at the end of 5 years. Interesting product, but I'm not sure exactly what needs it's meeting. And then you're starting to get some of the companies like the Aegons with their Five for Life who are looking at the more sophisticated dynamic hedging strategies. And I think, again, that's where the market's going to go there. Hedging and more dynamic asset allocation is starting to kick off. The investment banks, you can imagine, in the UK are running around visiting every company imaginable, trying to sell all sorts of solutions. Some of them are doing very well out of it. Most of them are still in their marketing phase.
Okay. Another question or comment? Yes, at the back there. Alan.
Alan Merton again. It's interesting. I'm really pleased to see some of this development. I've been doing a fair bit of work in the company I work for on these types of topics, including, Anthony, some of the things like thinking about how do you package up, providing for the retiree who's off on their overseas trip, having the garden watered and things like that. One of the challenges for the actuarial profession is actually taking the way we think in terms of innovation and risk management down to an individual level. And that links to the distribution issues that I think have been already raised. That I've learned as I've worked closer with financial planners that they're actually typically very good communicators. They're actually quite technical. I think actuaries often the same, but we think in portfolio level. I guess comment on some of this is the best thing about it is that I think we're moving more towards starting to think about what is the 20 or 30 years that a retiree faces? What are the things they can plan for and use their money, whether it's in the house or get access with a reverse mortgage versus the allocated pension or whatever else? But what are the risks that they're going to face and which of those are actually insurable? And at the moment, I think the financial planning profession has got a long way to go, which I think it can be helped by actuaries in terms of separating out the things you plan for from the things that you try and insure. And I think it's great to see some of these products coming out.
All right. Well, we've just about reached 12:30, so I think we'll close this session now. And I'd ask you all to thank Anthony and Pauline for their contributions. Thank you.